Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
10.5 million shares of General Motors changed hands on Wall Street today, and it's a safe bet most of them weren't bought or sold by mom-and-pop investors, which is a good thing, because we learned today GM just ain't what it used to be. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers to bring about ideas for nourishing the world. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday. It's April 24th today. We've been telling you for years about Detroit's problems, falling market share in the face of foreign competition, and rising costs to take care of workers and retirees. Every time we do it, we identify General Motors as the world's biggest car maker. Well, we can't say that anymore. Toyota took the top spot last quarter, bumping GM down after more than 70 years. Now, yes, this is just one quarter's worth of sales, but all signs are Toyota's going to be number one for a while. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Being number one in sales usually earns a company some bragging rights, but Toyota is having none of it.
That's really not part of our DNA. Over here at Toyota, we believe in Kaizen. It's the Japanese term for continuous improvement.
That's Toyota spokesperson Sona Iliff Moon, who downplays the company's achievement.
Ranking isn't really important to our customers. So we aren't focused on our ranking, but rather fulfilling our customers' needs.
Some suspect the company's modesty is driven by more than corporate culture. John Novak is an equity analyst with Morningstar.
They're fearful of a political and or consumer backlash for them being seen as someone who's toppling an American icon.
Novak says Toyota does appear strong enough to extend its winning quarter and become the best-selling car maker for the whole year.
What's clear is that on their current trajectories, Toyota will overtake GM on a full-year basis at some point, probably this year.
But, Novak says, the number of cars sold is not the benchmark at Toyota.
The company is more focused on profits and not unit sales. You can sell as many units as you want, but if you're not profitable, it doesn't mean much.
It's those profits that have made Toyota the number one auto stock on Wall Street. Based on the market capitalization, that is, the number of shares multiplied by the stock price, Toyota is valued at almost 12 times as much as GM. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The Bush administration's been spending a lot of time this year south of the border. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez was in Mexico back in February. The president traveled there last month. Today was Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson's turn. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
On Secretary Paulson's agenda, a meeting with Mexican President Felipe Calderon and other top Mexican officials. He also found time earlier today to visit a small juice factory in Mexico City called Bebidas Sanas, which means healthy beverages. The U.S. Treasurer, Ana Escobedo Cabral, was with him on the tour.
It was a phenomenal small enterprise. It's done great things. In the last 25 years, I think they went from something like 52,000 liters a year to 1.8 million liters a year. They went from employing just a handful of people to employing 53 people annually. It's really, I think, was a tremendous success story.
Secretary Paulson then held a town meeting with small business owners and financiers. Escobedo Cabral says a number of themes emerged.
Clearly, access to capital for small businesses is an issue. To compete globally is an issue. Having the opportunity to grow from these fairly small and medium-sized businesses to larger businesses is an issue.
Secretary Paulson says he's working with Mexican officials to make more money available to small businesses. Jeffrey David Au was ambassador to Mexico from 1998 to 2002. He says Paulson is wise to focus on eliminating poverty by creating jobs.
There's a new focus in Mexico on what has to be done to create jobs so that people can live decently, don't have to migrate to cities, don't have to migrate to the United States.
This is Secretary Paulson's third trip to Latin America in 10 months on the job, and he's planning yet another one, an extended tour in July. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
You've got your everyday market indicators, the old standbys like the Dow Jones Industrial Index, the S&P, and the NASDAQ Composite. Well, if you're tired of those, here's a brand spanking new one for you, the UBS Global Warming Index. London-based UBS Investment Bank launched the first climate change-related index today, as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
UBS is touting its Global Warming Index as a way for businesses to hedge their exposure to the uncertainties of climate change. But it's really just a clever way to brand what is essentially an index of weather futures. The GWI will be based on weather derivatives contracts currently traded on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. As temperatures in selected cities go up or down, so will the value of the index. And investors can essentially bet on the index's direction. The exchange's Felix Carabello says weather affects a third of our GDP. Weather futures offer companies some shelter from a storm.
For many years, businesses have expressed that there's nothing that they could have done about volatility and temperature risk. And now that the means are available, now Wall Street is expecting companies to go ahead and manage that weather risk.
Companies already trading in weather derivatives include reinsurers, hedge funds, banks, and energy companies. The market is now worth more than $45 billion. Compared to stocks, of course, that's a raindrop in a downpour. But Carabello believes investing in weather has a lot of potential.
We're beginning to see more conservative power companies and natural gas companies who actually get it, and they're now beginning to execute some of their hedging programs.
It should be noted that one big trader in weather derivatives isn't playing in that market anymore. That would be Enron. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
So close and yet so far on Wall Street. Still no Dow 13,000 for investors. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Apple is the biggest company so far to have been caught backdating its stock options. The company did its own internal investigation and cleared CEO Steve Jobs of any wrongdoing. But the company's former chief financial officer told a different tale today. Fred Anderson has agreed to pay $3.5 million to the SEC to settle his role in the scandal. And he says he told Jobs all about the potential problems backdating could bring. Stock options are just the latest example of companies not always being on the up and up. Congress tried to fix corporate misbehavior after Enron with the Sarbanes-Oxley law, but that's now being blamed for driving businesses out of American markets. Ben Steele runs the International Economics Program at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says Sarbox isn't entirely responsible.
Foreign companies that in the early 1990s would have listed on a U.S. stock exchange are leaving the country, as it were. They're much more likely to list in London than in New York. It's not as if U.S. investors don't have access to these stocks, but it is a blow to U.S. stock exchanges, in particular the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ.
And your take is that it's not really Sarbanes-Oxley, the corporate reform law that we passed after Enron, that's making this happen, is it?
Well, it's certainly not the original cause. Even foreigners that have concerns about raising capital in the United States understand that Sarbanes-Oxley was addressed mainly to U.S. firms in the wake of the scandals at Enron and WorldCom. One of the most influential initiatives, interestingly enough, came from the man who is now head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Christopher Cox. Back in 1999, when he was in Congress, he reported on the activities of Chinese companies that were alleged to be involved in things like weapons proliferation and technology acquisition in the United States in very sensitive areas. And Cox was the first to suggest that by controlling their access to the U.S. capital markets, we might be able to deter them from engaging in activities we didn't like. So many in Congress decided that the SEC needed to get involved. That raised very great concern among foreign companies who feared that if they listed on a U.S. securities exchange, then the SEC might be investigating their activities and at some point make it very difficult for them to continue their business. And that gives London a significant competitive advantage.
You can see how it's a delectable tool for Washington.
Oh,
right?
It is.
The U.S. predominance in the markets, and they say, ooh, we have this tool we can use.
That's precisely correct. It was considered to be costless. Congress didn't have to allocate any money to do this, and of course it was bloodless. We didn't have to send Marines around the world in order to pursue our foreign policy interest. We could just impose restrictions on the ability of companies to list on the New York Stock Exchange or issue bonds in the United States, and somehow our foreign policy interests would be served by this. But precisely the opposite has happened.
So here we find ourselves in the spring of 2007 with Christopher Cox, one of the first people to get on board with the capital sanctions movement, now running the Securities and Exchange Commission. We have people like New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and New York Senator Charles Schumer, in addition to the Secretary of the Treasury, saying we are losing competitiveness because of Sarbanes-Oxley, that is domestic corporate governance laws. Do you think there's a movement afoot to try to right the balance here and try to figure out what might be at the cause of foreign companies moving overseas?
Well, I think they're missing the key causes. Even if you were to eliminate Sarbanes-Oxley today, even if you were to eliminate the sort of class action lawsuits that foreign companies are very concerned about, this would not stop the exodus of foreign companies to London. What foreign companies want to see is a return to the days in which that they felt the U.S. capital markets were not politicized.
Ben Steele at the Council of Foreign Relations in New York. He directs the International Economics Program there. Mr. Steele, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
JetBlue confirmed today that leaving passengers stuck on an airplane for 9 hours can be bad for business. The discount carrier reported a $22 million first quarter loss today. It spent $41 million on canceled flights and hotel vouchers in the aftermath of that big storm back in February. And the company said lower demand and higher fuel prices won't make next quarter much better either. It's rough all the way around for airlines and airline passengers who are having to pay out of pocket for amenities that used to be standard, everything from food to pillows. Commentator Beth Tytel says it's time for the traveling public to fight back.
Okay, fine. Let the carriers bilk us for blankets and OJ. But turnaround's fair play. Next time I board a plane, I'm going to be armed with a price list of my own. If the flight attendant imprisons me with the beverage cart or bangs my arm or foot with that thing, I want 10 smackers, 20 if there's no apology. If I find trash from the previous flight in my seat back pocket or the lavatory's a disgusting mess, it's going to run them another 10. If the airline skimps on in-flight fresh air or makes me gate check my carry-on at the very last minute, depriving me of all reading material, things are going to start getting pricey. If my bags don't arrive on time, yes, the very ones I paid them to care for, I want punitive damages. A C-note sounds about right. Furthermore, annoyance charges will be levied whenever the English language is misused. Order me to stay in my seat until we come to a complete stop at the terminal building, and someone's going to pay. What other kind of stop is there but a complete one? Penalties will also be assessed for hollow offers. I want a free ticket from the next pilot who says, "If there's anything we up here in the cockpit can do to make your flight more comfortable, please let us know." Be real. You can't get anywhere near the cockpit these days, let alone ask the pilot for little favors. My pants are a little snug because I binged at Cinnabon. Is there anything you gentlemen can do? To be fair, airlines aren't the only entities committing offenses, which is why I want the power to assess passenger-on-passenger fees. You slam your seat all the way back, stealing the few inches of legroom I did have, or hog the overhead space, I'm starting a tab. And if you're sitting in one of those ordinary window seats, don't expect to crawl past me in my premium aisle seat for nothing. I take cash, credit cards, personal checks with two forms of ID. Anything, that is, but frequent flyer miles.
Beth Tytel is the author of the book From Here to Maternity.
Send us your thoughts. Just go to our website. It's marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says contact. Coming up, all right, whose birthday is it this time?
For our office, it was worthless to give gifts because we all wound up giving all the money to the receptionist anyway, who did all the work for us. She picked out all the gifts, she wrapped them for us, we didn't see them until they were opened in front of us at the party.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials felt the tug of gravity from the sinking housing market today. The Blue Chip Index gained 34 points, up a quarter of 1% to close at 12,953. The NASDAQ basically flat, closing at 2524. The S&P 500 fell half a point, closing at 1480 there. Existing home sales took the biggest tumble in 18 years. During February, the price of existing single-family homes in 10 metropolitan areas took the worst hit they've had since October of 1993. Not to pile on here, but consumers were queasy. The Consumer Confidence Index also fell significantly in April, the second consecutive monthly decline in that index. On the bright side, though, IBM, the world's biggest computer services company, rose 3.5%. Honeywell also got a 3.25% bump. Alcatel-Lucent jumped 4.75%, and AT&T rose 0.25%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dropped to 4.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for March. The Federal Reserve releases its latest Beige Book survey of regional economic conditions. And the House Education and Labor Committee examines unethical practices in the student loan industry. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'd been expecting the Chinese government to announce its long-term plan for dealing with climate change today. It's apparently become bogged down in a debate over there over whether cutting greenhouse gas emissions would hurt the Chinese economy, which will sound familiar to those who've been following Washington's own global warming debate. The Chinese economy is growing at a rate of more than 11% a year. The International Energy Agency says if nothing changes, within 25 years, China's pollution would be double that of the U.S., the EU, and Japan combined. One thing there is no speculation about, though, Beijing's air is already foul. And Marketplace's Scott Tong reports now on one bizarre solution.
Yes, you can mess with Mother Nature. Here's how. Spot a rain cloud, then load your rocket launcher with chemicals and fire. Wait 5, maybe 10 minutes, and according to the believers, you have created rain. So say proponents of what's called cloud seeding. 46-year-old Yu Yonggang is a shooter, a rainmaker. He thinks cloud seeding can clear Beijing's notorious smog.
It definitely does. The rain helps increase the air humidity and the air quality. Why is there less dust and sand in the air? That's the reason.
Many countries have tried artificial rainmaking. Russia, Israel, even the CIA tried it in Vietnam to flood enemy trails. China has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on it. It's even created an Institute for Weather Modification. Wang Guanghe works there. He explains the science.
It's a physical reaction. The chemicals from the rockets create ice crystals in the clouds. We found silver iodine is the most effective to make ice.
And that, of course, would make it a silver bullet. Wang sees cloud seeding as multi-purpose, a kind of public policy Swiss Army knife. It helps farmers worried about global warming and droughts. It helps factories dealing with hot summers and big AC bills, since the rain lowers the temperature. But issue number one in Beijing is the air quality. Atmospheric scientist Kenneth Ron has flown into the city several times. Here's how it looks from above.
If you put your nose to the window, press really hard and look down, you see something that's brown gunk. Gunk is not a nice word, but brown gunk.
You then descend through the gunk.
You're going along and you think, well, we're up so high. And then all of a sudden you say, oh, there's houses down there and there's roads and there's little cars and trucks. And then bang, you're on the ground right after that.
On a bad day, Beijing's air is seven times worse than a very smoggy day in, say, Philadelphia. China's government thinks 400,000 people die every year from illnesses related to pollution. One of the big culprits is fossil fuels. Coal provides 70% of China's energy. Gasoline powers the 1,000 new vehicles that hit Beijing's streets every day. Ask a local cabbie about all this, and you're in for a lengthy rant.
In the 60s, there were hardly any cars here. They didn't start increasing till the 70s. Now it's totally overboard.
I ask him about the 1970s, whether the skies were clear back then. His answer, roughly translated, is duh.
Of course I could see the sky. It was blue skies and white clouds back then. Now we get it about half the time. Pollution's out of hand.
The government says it's responding. It wants industries to burn less carbon relative to the economy, and it sets stiff car emission standards. It's all very long term. For now, though, Beijing wants clear skies for next year's Olympics. It's calling them the Green Games. And that's where the rainmakers come in, to wash away the smog for the opening ceremonies. A dozen men are wheeling out some late-model anti-aircraft cannons. The head of this group, Mr. Li, says once the scientists identify incoming rain clouds, his team has 3 minutes before showtime. Li thinks when he shoots a cloud, he creates rain about half the time, to which Kenneth Ron, the American scientist, responds.
We know that it doesn't work. How are you going to say whether it was your rocket or your airplanes that did it to those clouds? You can have an Indian rain dance, right? And after the Indian rain dance, sometimes it rains. And so you remember the events that worked.
As for the Olympics, he's forecasting smog. In Beijing, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is Administrative Professionals Day, which means today a lot of bosses are out frantically hunting for the right something for their assistants. Thoughtful, but not too personal, like any good office gift should be. No hidden emotional value, and certainly nothing too risque. Colleagues wind up buying each other presents for all sorts of occasions, but sometimes there's just not much joy in it. Alex Goldmark looked into gift-giving on the job.
If you work in an office, you've heard it before.
Hey, it's John from accounting's birthday tomorrow. Want to chip in for a cake?
Some places, it's corporate culture. In others, it's organized by that overzealous coworker down the hall who just loves cake. So, how do you feel about contributing for birthday gifts or picking your boss's name in Secret Santa? I wanted to get some honest answers, so I asked around at about a dozen companies.
For our office, it was worthless to give gifts because we all wound up giving all the money to the receptionist anyway who did all the work for us. She picked out all the gifts, she wrapped them for us, we didn't see them until they were opened in front of us at the party.
Mike, who, big surprise, doesn't want his company or last name used, is an engineer from New York. And he says before the receptionist took over the shopping duties, the Secret Santa was even worse.
Well, we had a mix-up at our office where a new guy that started received a slip of paper that said Tony on it and didn't realize that it was really referring to Anthony, who was a separate person in the office. One a vice president, one an entry-level engineer. The vice president received like a cap and some kind of stuffed animal or something with a Mets logo on it, and he was the biggest Yankee fan we have in the office.
New York baseball rivalries are bad, But the real problem here is that Mike and his coworkers felt pressured to buy gifts, so they weren't from the heart. Buying that kind of gift can seem like a waste of time, which was the biggest complaint I heard.
If your culture is one that implicitly or explicitly requires the giving of gifts, that's a problem.
Johnny Taylor is a board member at the Society for Human Resource Management. He says employees resent being pressured to spend money on their coworkers. But data from his organization show they sure do like to receive gifts. And when they do, they're less likely to quit.
What we clearly know is spot gifts given to employees throughout the year to recognize their achievements and or their value to the organization go a long way toward retention. And we know that is fact.
There's something about getting the tangible and wearing it and showing it off that I don't think you can put a price on that. I don't think I'd want it in my paycheck.
Judith Yannarelli is an administrative assistant at the New Jersey utility, PSE&G. She loves gifts, and every year she buys up to $25,000 worth of gifts for 500 employees on behalf of her boss. Mostly, it's clothing branded with the company logo.
Here's something that we did, my boss did for his senior leadership team this year because they work so hard. And this is this came from Land's End. I hope I can mention the company.
These black pullover jackets were a hit, she says. And whenever an employee goes above and beyond, they get something like this as recognition.
The point of a gift really is to show appreciation, to say thank you.
Peter Post is the director of the Emily Post Institute for Etiquette. He says the best gifts are personal but not too personal, like a coffee table book about a shared hobby.
I don't think it's a problem to give a gift to a person that is saying, I thought of you and the things you're interested in. When you cross the line into that personal gift, that lingerie, the colognes, that's a different kind of I thought of you.
And that's not okay. So, if you want to be safe, get them a knickknack for their desk or something simple.
Even flowers for a man would be terrific. Okay, they love getting flowers. People out there shouldn't assume that men don't enjoy flowers. They do.
Can I get an orchid? I like those. In Los Angeles, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
These final notes, the embattled internet phone company Vonage can breathe a little easier while it fights its patent lawsuits. A federal appeals court has decided to let Vonage keep on signing up new customers while the dispute makes its way through the courts. That's a change from a ruling earlier this month after a jury found in March that Vonage had infringed on some patents owned by Verizon. Vonage is appealing, but in the meantime, it's business as usual for the company, or so says a spokesperson. Business as usual for investors, too, I guess. Vonage shares jumped almost 50% on that news today. And this, first it was dog food, now it looks like hog feed has been contaminated with melamine. That's the news from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration today. No specific data is yet available on the numbers of hogs that could be affected, but the administration says thousands could have been given the tainted feed. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 34 points. That's about a quarter of 1%. The NASDAQ picked up less than a point, basically flat. The S&P 500 dropped, but less than a point, so we'll call it, flat there, too. Thanks today to Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, the NASDAQ and the NYSE duke it out over ticker symbols.
This is really a question of who owns the alphabet.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.